For a moment he didn't think he would be able to get up. Getting up was far beyond him. He would simply lie here, listening to the chorus of peepers from Little God Swamp somewhere behind him, and feeling the chorus of aches and pains inside his own body. He would lie here until he went to sleep, or died. Probably the latter. He could remember slipping the canvas bundle into the hole he had dug, and pushing most of the earth back into the hole with his bare hands, and he believed he could remember piling the rocks up, building from a broad base to a point. From then to now, he remembered very little. He had obviously gotten back down the steps again, or he wouldn't be here, which was where? Looking around, he thought he recognized one of the groves of great old pines not far beyond the deadfall. Could he have made it all the way back through Little God Swamp without knowing it? He supposed it was possible. Just. This is far enough. I'll just sleep here. But it was that thought, so falsely comforting, that got him to his feet and moving again. Because if he stayed here, that thing might find him. That thing might be in the woods and looking for him right this moment. He scrubbed his hand up to his face, palm first, and was stupidly surprised to see blood on his hand. At some point he'd given himself a nosebleed. "Who gives a fuck?" he muttered hoarsely, and grubbed apathetically around him until he had found the pick and shovel again. 10 minutes later, the deadfall loomed ahead. Lewis climbed it, stumbling repeatedly but somehow not falling until he was almost down. Then he glanced at his feet. A branch promptly snapped.
"Don't look down," Judd had said.
Another branch tumbled, spilling his foot outward, and he fell with a thud on his side, the wind knocked out of him. "I'll be goddamned if this isn't the second graveyard I've fallen into tonight, and I'll be goddamned if two isn't enough." He began to feel around for the pick and shovel again, and laid his hands on them at last. For a moment he surveyed his surroundings, visible by starlight. Nearby was the grave of Smucky.
"He was obedient," Lewis thought wearily.
"And tricksy, kilt on the highway." The wind still blew strongly, and he could hear the faint ting, ting, ting of a piece of metal. Perhaps it had once been a Del Monte can, cut laboriously by a grieving pet owner with his father's tin snips, and then flattened out with a hammer and nailed to a stick, and that brought the fear back again. He was too tired now to feel it as more than a somehow sickening pulse beat. He had done it. That steady ting, ting, ting sound coming out of the darkness brought it home to him more than anything else. He walked through the pet cemetery, past the grave of Marta, our pet rabbit, who had died March 1, 1965, and near the barrow of General Patton. He stepped over the ragged chunk of board that marked the final resting place of Polynesia. The tick of metal was louder now, and he paused, looking down. Here atop a slightly leaning board that had been driven into the ground was a tin rectangle, and by starlight Lewis read, "Ringo, our hamster, 1964 to 1965. It was this piece of tin that was ticking repeatedly off the boards of the pet cemetery's entry arch. Lewis reached down to bend the piece of tin back, and then froze, scalp crawling. Something was moving back there. Something was moving on the other side of the deadfall. What he heard was a stealthy kind of sound. The furtive crackle of pine needles, the dry pop of a twig, the rattle of underbrush. They were almost lost under the sough of the wind through the pines. "Gage?" Lewis called hoarsely. The very realization of what he was doing, standing here in the dark and calling his dead son, pulled his scalp stiff and brought his hair up on end. He began to shudder helplessly and steadily, as if with a sick and killing fever. "Gage?"
The sounds had died away. Not yet. It's too early. Don't ask me how I know, but I do. That isn't Gage over there. That's something else. He suddenly thought of Ellie telling him, "He called Lazarus come forth, because if he hadn't called for Lazarus by name, everyone in that graveyard would have risen." On the other side of the deadfall, those sounds had begun again. On the other side of the barrier. Almost, but not quite, hidden under the wind. As if something blind were stalking him with ancient instincts. His dreadfully overstimulated brain conjured horrible, sickening pictures. A giant mole. A great bat that flopped through the underbrush, rather than flying. Lewis backed out of the pet cemetery, not turning his back to the deadfall. That ghost-like glimmer, a livid scar on the dark, until he was well down the path. Then he began to hurry, and perhaps a quarter of a mile before the path ran out of the woods and into the field behind his house, he found enough left inside him to run. Lewis slung the pick and shovel indifferently inside the garage and stood for a moment at the head of his driveway, looking first back the way he had come, and then up at the sky. It was 4:15 in the morning, and he supposed dawn could not be so far away. Light would already be 3/4 of the way across the Atlantic, but for now, here in Ludlow, the night held hard. The wind blew steadily. He went into the house, feeling his way along the side of the garage and unlocking the back door. He went through the kitchen, without turning on a light, and stepped into the small bathroom between the kitchen and the dining room. Here he did snap on a light, and the first thing he saw was Church, curled up on top of the toilet tank, staring at him with those muddy yellow-green eyes. "Church," he said. "I thought someone put you out." Church only looked at him from atop the toilet tank. Yes, someone had put Church out. He had done it himself. He remembered that very clearly, just as he remembered replacing the window pane down cellar that time, and then telling himself that he had taken care of the problem. But exactly whom had he been kidding? When Church wanted to get in, Church got in. Because Church was different now. It didn't matter. In this dull, exhausted aftermath, nothing seemed to matter. He felt like something less than human now, one of George Romero's stupid, lurching movie zombies, or maybe someone who had escaped from T.S. Eliot's poem about the hollow man. "I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling through Little God Swamp and up to the Micmac burying ground," he thought, and uttered a dry chuckle. "Headpiece full of straw, Church," he said in his croaking voice. He was unbuttoning his shirt now. "That's me. You better believe it." There was a nice bruise coming on his left side, about halfway up his ribcage, and when he rolled up his pants leg, he saw that the knee he had banged on the gravestone was swelling up like a balloon. It had already turned a rotten purple-black, and he supposed that as soon as he stopped flexing it, the joint would become stiff and painfully obdurate, as if it had been dipped in cement. It looked like one of those injuries that might want to converse with him on rainy days for the rest of his life. He reached out a hand to stroke Church, wanting some sort of comfort, but the cat leapt down from the toilet tank, staggering in that drunken and weirdly unfeline way, and left for some other place. It spared Lewis one flat, yellow glance as it went. There was Ben Gay in the medicine cabinet. Lewis lowered the toilet seat, sat down, and smeared a gob on his bad knee. Then he rubbed some more on the small of his back. A clumsy operation. He left the toilet and walked into the living room. He turned on the hall light and stood there at the foot of the stairs for a moment, looking stupidly around. How strange it all seemed. Here was where he had stood on Christmas Eve, when he had given Rachel the sapphire. It had been in the pocket of his robe. There was his chair, where he had done his best to explain the facts of death to Ellie after Norma Crandall's fatal heart attack, facts he had found ultimately unacceptable to himself. The Christmas tree had stood in that corner, Ellie's construction paper turkey, the one that had reminded Lewis of some sort of futuristic crow, had been scotch-taped in that window, and much earlier the entire room had been empty except for the United Van Lines boxes, filled with their family possessions and trucked across half the country from the Midwest. He remembered thinking that their things looked very insignificant, boxed up like that. A small enough bulwark between his family and the coldness of all the outer world, where their names and their family customs were not known. How strange it all seemed, and how he wished they had never heard of the University of Maine, or Ludlow, or Judd and Norma Crandall, or any of it. He went upstairs, and in the bathroom at the top he got the stool, stood on it, and took down the small black bag from on top of the medicine cabinet. He took this into the master bedroom, sat down, and began to rummage through it. Yes, there were syringes in case he needed one, and amid the rolls of surgical tape and surgical scissors and neatly wrapped papers of surgical gut were several ampules of very deadly stuff. If needed. Lewis snapped the bag shut and put it by the bed. He turned off the overhead light, then lay down, hands behind his head. To lie here on his back, at rest, was exquisite. His thoughts turned to Disney World again. He saw himself in a plain white uniform, driving a white van with the Mouse Ears logo on it. Nothing to indicate it was a rescue unit on the outside, of course. Nothing to scare the paying customers. Gage was sitting beside him, his skin deeply tanned, the whites of his eyes bluish with health. Here, just to his left, was Goofy, shaking hands with a little boy. The kid was in a trance of wonder. Here was Winnie the Pooh, posing with two laughing grandmas in pantsuits, so a third laughing grandma could snap their pictures. Here was a little girl in her best dress crying, "I love you, Tigger! I love you, Tigger!" He and his son were on patrol. He and his son were the sentries in this magic land, and they cruised endlessly in their white van with the red dashboard flasher neatly and sensibly covered. They were not looking for trouble, not they, but they were ready for it, should it show its face. That it was lurking even here, in a place dedicated to such innocent pleasures, could not be denied. Some grinning man buying film along Main Street could clutch his chest as the heart attack struck. A pregnant woman might suddenly feel the labor pains start as she walked down the steps from the Sky Chariot. A teenage girl as pretty as a Norman Rockwell cover might suddenly collapse in a flopping epileptic fit, loafers rattling out a jagged backbeat on the cement as the signals in her brain suddenly jammed up. There were sunstroke and heatstroke and brainstroke, and perhaps at the end of some sultry Orlando summer afternoon, there might even be a stroke of lightning. There was even Oz the Great and Terrible himself here. He might be glimpsed walking around near the monorail's point of egress into the Magic Kingdom, or peering down from one of the flying Dumbos with his flat and stupid gaze. Down here, Lewis and Gage had come to know him as just another amusement park figure, like Goofy, or Mickey, or Tigger, or the estimable Mr. D. Duck. He was the one, however, with whom no one wanted his or her picture taken, the one to whom no one wanted to introduce his son or daughter. Lewis and Gage knew him. They had met him and faced him down in New England some time ago. He was waiting to choke you on a marble, to smother you with a dry-cleaning bag, to sizzle you into eternity with a fast and lethal bogey of electricity, available at your nearest switchplate or vacant light socket right now. There was death in a quarter bag of peanuts, an aspirated piece of steak, the next pack of cigarettes. He was around all the time. He monitored all the checkpoints between the mortal and the eternal. Dirty needles, poison beetles, downed live wires, forest fires, whirling roller skates that shot nerdy little kids into busy intersections. When you got into the bathtub to take a shower, Oz got right in there, too. Shower with a friend. When you got on an airplane, Oz took your boarding pass. He was in the water you drank, the food you ate. "Who's out there?" you howled into the dark when you were frightened and all alone. And it was his answer that came back.
"Don't be afraid. It's just me. Hi, how are you? You got cancer of the bowel? What a bummer. So sorry, Charlie. Septicemia? Leukemia? Atherosclerosis? Coronary thrombosis? Encephalitis? Osteomyelitis? Hey-ho, let's go. Junkie in a doorway with a knife? Phone call in the middle of the night? Blood cooking in battery acid on some exit ramp in North Carolina? Big handfuls of pills, munch 'em up. That peculiar blue cast of the fingernails following asphyxiation. In its final grim struggle to survive, the brain takes all the oxygen that is left, even that in those living cells under the nails. Hi, folks. My name's Oz the Great and Terrible, but you can call me Oz if you want. Hell, we're old friends by now. Just stop by to whop you with a little congestive heart failure or a cranial blood clot or something. Can't stay. Gotta see a woman about a breech birth. Then I've got a little smoke inhalation job to do in Omaha." And that thin voice is crying,
"I love you, Tigger. I love you. I believe in you, Tigger. I will always love you and believe in you, and I will stay young. And the only Oz to ever live in my heart will be that gentle faker from Nebraska. I love you."
We cruise, my son and I, because the essence of it isn't war or sex, but only that sickening, noble, hopeless battle against Oz the Great and Terrible. He and I, in our white van, under this bright Florida sky, we cruise, and the red flasher is hooded, but it is there if we need it, and none need know but us, because the soil of a man's heart is stonier. A man grows what he can and tends it. Thinking such troubled, half-dreaming thoughts, Lewis Creed slipped away, unplugging his connections to waking reality, line by line, until all thought ceased and exhaustion dragged him down to black, dreamless unconsciousness. Just before the first signs of dawn touched the sky in the east, there were footsteps on the stairs. They were slow and clumsy, but purposeful. A shadow moved in the shadows of the hall. A smell came with it. A stench. Lewis, even in his thick sleep, muttered and turned away from that smell. There was the steady pull and release of respiration. The shape stood outside the master bedroom door for some little time, not moving. Then it came inside. Lewis's face was buried in his pillow. White hands reached out, and there was a click as the black doctor's bag by the bed was opened. A low clink and shift as the things inside were moved. The hands explored, pushing aside drugs and ampules and syringes with no interest at all. Now they found something and held it up. In the first dim light, there was a gleam of silver. The shadowy thing left the room. Part 3. Oz the Great and Terrible. Jesus, therefore, groaning inside of himself and full of trouble, came to the grave. It was a cave, and a stone had been raised against the mouth. "Roll away the stone," Jesus said. Martha said, "Lord, by this time he will have begun to rot. He has been dead 4 days." And when he had prayed a while, Jesus raised his voice and cried, "Lazarus, come forth!" And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus said to them, "Loose him and let him go." John's Gospel, paraphrase.
I only just thought of it, she said hysterically. Why didn't I think of it before? Why didn't you think of it?
Think of what? He questioned.
The other two wishes, she replied rapidly. We've only had one.
Was that not enough? He demanded fiercely.
No, she cried triumphantly. We'll have one more. Go down and get it quickly, and wish our boy alive again.
W.W. Jacobs, The Monkey's Paw.
58. Judd Crandall came awake with a sudden jerk, almost falling out of his chair. He had no idea how long he had slept. It could have been 15 minutes or 3 hours. He looked at his watch and saw that it was 5 minutes of 5. There was a feeling that everything in the room had been subtly shifted out of position, and there was a line of pain across his back from sleeping sitting up.
Oh, you stupid old man. Look what you've gone and done.
But he knew better. In his heart, he knew better. It wasn't just him. He hadn't simply fallen asleep on watch. He had been put to sleep. That frightened him. But one thing frightened him more. What had awakened him? He was under the impression that there had been some sound. Some... He held his breath, listening over the papery rustle of his heart. Here was a sound, not the same one that had awakened him, but something. The faint creak of hinges. Judd knew every sound in this house. Which floorboards creaked, which stair levels squeaked, where along the gutters the wind was apt to hoot and sing when it was drunkenly high, as it had been last night. He knew this sound as well as any of those. The heavy front door, the one that communicated between his porch and the front hall, had just swung open. And with that information to go on, his mind was able to remember the sound that had awakened him. It had been the slow expansion of the spring on the screen door, communicating between the porch and the front walk. Lewis, he called, but with no real hope. That wasn't Lewis out there. Whatever was out there had been sent to punish an old man for his pride and vanity. Footsteps moved slowly up the hall toward the living room.
Lewis,
he tried to call again, but only a faint croak actually emerged, because now he could smell the thing which had come into his house here at the end of the night. It was a dirty, low smell. The smell of poisoned tidal flats. Judd could make out bulking shapes in the gloom. Norma's armoire, the Welsh dresser, the high boy. But no details. He tried to get to his feet on legs that had gone to water, his mind screaming that he needed more time, that he was too old to face this again without more time. Timmy Baderman had been bad enough. And Judd had been young then. The swing door opened and let in shadows. One of the shadows was more substantial than the others. Dear God, that stink. Shuffling steps in the darkness.
Gage?
Judd gained his feet at last. From one corner of his eye, he saw the roll of cigarette ash in the Jim Beam ashtray.
Gage, is that you?
A hideous, mewling sound now arose, and for a moment all of Judd's bones turned to white ice. It was not Lewis's son returned from the grave, but some hideous monster. No, it was neither. It was Church, crouched in the hall doorway, making that sound. The cat's eyes flared like dirty lamps. Then his eyes moved in the other direction, and fixed on the thing which had come in with the cat. Judd began to back up, trying to catch at his thoughts, trying to hold on to his reason in the face of that smell. Oh, it was cold in here. The thing had brought its chill with it. Judd rocked unsteadily on his feet. It was the cat twining around his legs, making him totter. It was purring. Judd kicked at it, driving it away.
It bared its teeth at him and hissed.
Think. Oh, think, you stupid old man. It mayn't be too late. Even yet, it mayn't be too late. It's back, but it can be killed again. If you can only do it. If you can only think.
He backed away toward the kitchen, and he suddenly remembered the utensil drawer beside the sink. There was a meat cleaver in that drawer. His thin shank struck the swinging door that led into the kitchen, and he pushed it open. The thing that had come into his house was still indistinct, but Judd could hear it breathing. He could see one white hand swinging back and forth. There was something in that hand, but he could not make out what. The door swung back as he entered the kitchen, and Judd at last turned his back and ran to the utensil drawer. He jerked it open and found the cleaver's worn hardwood handle. He snatched it up and turned toward the door again. He even took a step or two toward it. Some of his courage had come back.
Remember, it ain't a kid. It may scream or something when it sees you've got its number. It may cry, but you ain't gonna be fooled. You've been fooled too many times already, old man. This is your last chance.
The swing door opened again, but at first only the cat came through. Judd's eye followed it for a moment, and then he looked up again. The kitchen faced east, and dawn's first light came in through the windows, faint and milky white. Not much light, but enough. Too much. Gage Creed came in, dressed in his burial suit. Moss was growing on the suit's shoulders and lapels. Moss had fouled his white shirt. His fine blonde hair was caked with dirt. One eye had gone to the wall. It stared off into space with terrible concentration. The other was fixed on Judd. Gage was grinning at him.
Hello, Judd.
Gage piped in a babyish but perfectly understandable voice.
I've come to send your rotten, stinking old soul straight to hell. You fucked with me once. Did you think I wouldn't come back sooner or later and fuck with you?
Judd raised the cleaver.
Come on and get your pecker out, then. Whatever you are. We'll see who fucks with who.
Norma's dead, and there'll be no one to mourn you,
Gage said.
What a cheap slut she was. She fucked every one of your friends, Judd. She let them put it up her ass. That's how she liked it best. She's burning down in hell, arthritis and all. I saw her there, Judd. I saw her there.
It lurched two steps toward him, shoes leaving muddy tracks on the warm linoleum. It held one hand out in front of it, as if to shake with him. The other hand was curled behind its back.
Listen, Judd,
it whispered, and then its mouth hung open, baring small milk teeth, and although the lips did not move, Norma's voice issued forth.
I laughed at you. We all laughed at you. How we laughed.
Stop it, the cleaver jittered in his hand.
We did it in our bed. Herc and I did it. I did it with George. I did it with all of them. I knew about your whores, but you never knew you married a whore. And how we laughed, Judd. We rutted together and we laughed at—
Stop it!
Judd screamed. He sprang at the tiny swaying figure in its dirty burial suit. And that was when the cat arrowed out of the darkness under the butcher block where it had been crouched. It was hissing, its ears laid back along the bullet of its skull, and it tripped Judd up just as neat as you please. The cleaver flew out of his hand. It skittered across the humped and faded linoleum, blade and handle swiftly changing places as it whirled. It struck the baseboard with a thin clang and slid under the refrigerator. Judd realized that he had been fooled again, and the only consolation was that it was for the final time. The cat was on his legs, mouth open, eyes blazing, hissing like a tea kettle. And then Gage was on him, grinning a happy black grin, eyes moon-shaped, rimmed with red, and his right hand came out from behind his back, and Judd saw that what he had been holding when he came in was a scalpel from Lewis's black bag.
"Oh, my dear Jesus!"
Judd managed and put his right hand up to block the blow. And here was an optical illusion. Surely his mind had snapped because it appeared that the scalpel was on both sides of his palm at the same time. Then something warm began to drizzle down on his face, and he understood.
"I'm gonna fuck with you, old man,"
the gauge thing chortled, blowing its poison breath in his face.
"I'm gonna fuck with you. I'm gonna fuck with you all I want."
Judd flailed and got hold of Gage's wrist. Skin peeled off like parchment in his hand. The scalpel was yanked out of his hand, leaving a vertical mouth.
"All I want!"
The scalpel came down again. And again. And again. 59.
"Try it now, ma'am,"
the truck driver said. He was looking into the engine cavity of Rachel's rented car. She turned the key. The Chevette's engine roared into life. The truck driver slammed the hood down and came around to her window, wiping his hands on a big blue handkerchief. He had a pleasant, ruddy face. A Dysart's truck stop cap was tilted back on his head.
"Thank you very much,"
Rachel said, on the verge of tears.
"I just didn't know what I was going to do."
"Ah, a kid could have fixed that," the trucker said. "But it was funny. Never seen something like that go wrong on such a new car, anyway."
"Why? What was it?"
"One of your battery cables come right off. Wasn't nobody friggin' with it, was there?"
"No,"
Rachel said, and she thought again of that feeling she'd had. That feeling of running into the rubber band of the world's biggest slingshot.
"Must have jogged her loose just riding along, I guess. But you won't have no more trouble with your cables, anyway. I tightened them up real good."
"Could I give you some money?"
Rachel asked timidly. The trucker roared with laughter.
"Not me, lady. Us guys are the knights of the road, remember?"
She smiled.
"Well, thank you."
"More'n welcome."
He gave her a good grin, incongruously full of sunshine at this hour of the morning. Rachel smiled and drove carefully across the parking lot to the feeder road. She glanced both ways for traffic, and 5 minutes later was back on the turnpike again, headed north. The coffee had helped more than she would have believed. She felt totally awake now, not the slightest bit dozy, her eyes as big as doorknobs. That feather of unease touched her again, that absurd feeling that she was being manipulated.
"The battery cable coming off the terminal post like that. So she could be held up just long enough for..."
She laughed nervously.
"Long enough for what?"
"For something irrevocable to happen." That was stupid. Ridiculous. But Rachel began to push the little car along faster nonetheless. At 5 o'clock, as Judd was trying to ward off a scalpel stolen from the black bag of his good friend Dr. Lewis Creed, and as her daughter was awakening bolt upright in bed, screaming in the grip of a nightmare which she could mercifully not remember, Rachel left the turnpike, drove the Hammond Street cutoff close to the cemetery, where a spade was now the only thing buried in her son's coffin, and crossed the Bangor Brewer Bridge. By 5:15, she was on Route 15 and headed for Ludlow. She had decided to go directly to Judd's. She would make good on at least that much of her promise. The Civic was not in their driveway anyway, and although she supposed it might be in the garage, their house had a sleeping, unoccupied look. No intuition suggested to her that Lewis might be home. Rachel parked behind Judd's pickup and got out of the Chevette, looking around carefully. The grass was heavy with dew, sparkling in this clear new light. Somewhere a bird sang and then was silent. On the few occasions since her pre-teenage years, when she had been awake and alone at dawn without some responsibility to fulfill as the reason, she had a lonely but somehow uplifted feeling, a paradoxical sense of newness and continuity. This morning she felt nothing so clean and good. there was only a dragging sense of unease, which she could not entirely charge off to the terrible 24 hours just gone by, and her recent bereavement. She mounted the porch steps and opened the screen door, meaning to use the old-fashioned bell on the front door. She had been charmed by that bell the first time she and Lewis came over together. You twisted it clockwise, and it uttered a loud but musical cry that was anachronistic and delightful. She reached for it now, then glanced down at the porch floor and frowned. There were muddy tracks on the mat. Looking around, she saw that they led from the screen door to this one. Very small tracks. A child's tracks, by the look of them. But she had been driving all night, and there had been no rain. Wind, but no rain. She looked at the tracks for a long time. Too long, really. And discovered she had to force her hand back to the turn bell. She grasped it, and then her hand fell away again.
I'm anticipating, that's all. Anticipating the sound of that bell in this stillness. He's probably gone to sleep after all, and it will startle him awake.
But that wasn't what she was afraid of. She had been nervous, scared in some deep and diffuse way ever since she had found it so hard to stay awake. But this sharp fear was something new, something which had solely to do with those small tracks.
Tracks that were the size...
Her mind tried to block this thought, but it was too tired, too slow.
Of Gage's feet. Oh, stop it! Can't you stop it?
She reached out and twisted the bell. Its sound was even louder than she remembered, but not so musical. It was a harsh, choked scream in the stillness. Rachel jumped back, uttering a nervous little laugh that had absolutely no humor in it at all. She waited for Judd's footsteps, but his footsteps did not come. There was silence, and more silence, and she was beginning to debate in her own mind whether or not she could bring herself to twist that iron butterfly shape again, when a sound did come from behind the door, a sound she would not have expected in her wildest surmises.
Meow. Meow. Meow.
Church? She asked, startled and puzzled. She bent forward, but it was of course impossible to see in. The door's glass panel had been covered with a neat white curtain. Norma's work.
Church, is that you?
Meow.
Rachel tried the door. It was unlocked. Church was there, sitting in the hallway with its tail coiled neatly around its feet. The cat's fur was streaked with something dark.
Mud,
Rachel thought, and then saw that the beads of liquid caught in Church's whiskers were red. He raised one paw and began to lick it, his eyes never leaving her face.
Judd!
She called out, really alarmed now. She stepped just inside the door. The house gave back no answer, only silence. Rachel tried to think, but all at once images of her sister Zelda had begun to creep into her mind, blurring thought. How her hands had twisted. How she used to slam her head against the wall sometimes when she was angry. The paper had been all torn there, the plaster beneath torn and broken. This was no time to think of Zelda, not when Judd might be hurt. Suppose he had fallen down. He was an old man.
Think about that, not about the dreams you had as a kid.
Dreams of opening the closet and having Zelda spring out at you with her blackened, grinning face. Dreams of being in the bathtub and seeing Zelda's eyes peering out of the drain. Dreams of Zelda lurking in the basement behind the furnace. Dreams. Church opened his mouth, exposing his sharp teeth, and cried,
"Wow!"
again.
Lewis was right. We never should have had him fixed. He's never seemed right since then. But Lewis said it would take away all of his aggressive instincts. He was wrong about that anyway. Church still hunts. He,
"Wow!"
Church cried again, then turned and darted up the stairs.
Judd? She called again. Are you up there?
Wow!
Church cried from the top of the stairs, as if to confirm the fact, and then he disappeared down the hall.
How did he get in, anyway? Did Judd let him in? Why?
Rachel shifted from one foot to the other, wondering what to do next. The worst of it was that all of it seemed somehow managed, as if something wanted her to be there, and then there was a groan from upstairs, low and filled with pain. Judd's voice, surely Judd's voice.
He's fallen in the bathroom, or maybe tripped, broken a leg, or sprained his hip maybe, the bones of the older brittle. And what in the name of God are you thinking of, girl, standing down here and shifting back and forth, like you had to go to the bathroom? That was blood on Church, blood. Judd's hurt, and you're just standing here. What's wrong with you? Judd!
The groan came again, and she ran up the stairs. She had never been up here before, and because the hall's only window faced west, toward the river, it was still very dark. The hallways ran straight and wide beside the stairwell and toward the back of the house, the cherry wood rail gleaming with mellow elegance. There was a picture of the Acropolis on the wall, and... It's Zelda. All these years she's been after you. And now it's her time. Open the right door and she'll be there, with her humped and twisted back smelling of piss and death. It's Zelda. It's her time. And finally she caught up with you. The groan came again, low, from behind the second door on the right. Rachel began to walk toward that door, her heels clacking on the boards. It seemed to her that she was going through some sort of warp, not a time warp or a space warp, but a size warp. She was getting smaller. The picture of the Acropolis was floating higher and higher, and that cut glass doorknob would soon be at eye level. Her hand stretched out for it, and before she could even touch it, the door was snatched open. Zelda stood there. She was hunched and twisted, her body so cruelly deformed that she had actually become a dwarf, little more than 2 feet high. And for some reason Zelda was wearing the suit they had buried Gage in. But it was Zelda, all right, her eyes alight with an insane glee, her face a rattled purple. It was Zelda screaming.
I finally came back for you, Rachel. I'm going to twist your back like mine, and you'll never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again.
Church was perched on one of her shoulders, and Zelda's face swam and changed. And Rachel saw, with spiraling, sickening horror, that it really wasn't Zelda at all. How could she have made such a stupid mistake? It was Gage. His face was not black but dirty, smeared with blood. And it was swollen, as if he had been terribly hurt, and then put back together again by crude, uncaring hands. She cried his name and held her arms out. He ran to her and climbed into them, and all the time one hand remained behind his back, as if with a bunch of posies picked in someone's back meadow.
"I brought you something, Mommy!"
he screamed.
"I brought you something, Mommy! I brought you something! I brought you something!"
60. Lewis Creed woke up with the sun blazing full in his eyes. He tried to get up and grimaced at the stab of pain in his back. It was huge. He fell back on the pillow and glanced down at himself, still fully dressed. Christ. He lay there for a long moment, steeling himself against the stiffness that had settled into every muscle, and then he sat up.
Oh, shit, he whispered.
For a few seconds the room seesawed gently but perceptibly. His back throbbed like a bad tooth, and when he moved his head, it felt as if the tendons in his neck had been replaced by rusty bandsaw blades. But his knee was really the worst. The Bengay hadn't done a thing for it. He should have given himself a fucking cortisone shot. His pants were drawn tightly against the knee by the swelling.
It looked like there was a balloon under there.
"Really jobbed it," he muttered. "Boy, oh boy, did I ever."
He bent it very slowly, so he could sit on the edge of the bed, lips pressed so tightly together that they were white. Then he began to flex it a bit, listening to the pain talk, trying to decide just how bad it really was. If it might be,
"Gage! Is Gage back?"
That got him on his feet in spite of the pain. He lurched across the room like Matt Dillon's old sidekick, Chester. He went through the door and across the hall into Gage's room, but the room was empty. He limped down to Ellie's room, which was also empty, and then into the spare room. That room, which faced the highway, was also empty, but there was a strange car across the road, parked behind Judd's truck. So what? So a strange vehicle over there could mean trouble. That was so what. Lewis drew the curtain aside and examined the vehicle more closely. It was a small blue car, a Chevette, and curled up on top of it, apparently sleeping, was Church. He looked for a long time before letting the curtain go. Judd had company, that was all, so what? And it was maybe too early to worry about what was or was not going to happen with Gage. Church hadn't come back until almost 1 o'clock, and it was only 9 o'clock now. 9 o'clock on a beautiful May morning. He would simply go downstairs and make some coffee, get out the heating pad and wrap it around his knee, and...
"And what's Church doing on top of that car?"
"Oh, come on," he said aloud, and began to limp back down the hall. Cat slept anywhere and everywhere. It was the nature of the beast.
"Except Church doesn't cross the road anymore, remember?"
"Forget it," he muttered, and paused halfway down the stairs, which he was working his way down almost side saddle. Talking to himself, that was bad. That was...
"What was that thing in the woods last night?"
The thought came to him unbidden, making him tighten his lips the way the pain in his knee had done when he had swung it out of bed. He had dreamed about the thing in the woods last night. His dreams of Disney World had seemed to blend naturally and with a deadly ease into dreams of that thing. He dreamed that it had touched him, spoiling all good dreams forever, rotting all good intentions. It was the Wendigo, and it had turned him into not just a cannibal, but the father of cannibals. In his dream, he had been in the pet cemetery again, but not alone. Bill and Timmy Baderman had been there. Judd had been there, looking ghostly and dead, holding his dog Spot on a clothes-rope leash. Lester Morgan was there with Hanratty the Bull on a length of car-towing chain. Hanratty was lying on his side, looking around with a stupid, drugged fury. And for some reason, Rachel was there, too. And she'd had some sort of accident at the dinner table. Spilled a bottle of ketchup or maybe dropped a dish of cranberry jelly, maybe, because her dress was splattered with red stains. And then, rising behind the deadfall to a titanic height, its skin a cracked reptilian yellow, its eyes great hooded fog lamps, its ears not ears at all but massive curling horns, was the Wendigo, a beast that looked like a lizard born of a woman. It pointed its horny, nailed finger at all of them as they craned their necks up and up to watch it.
"Stop!"
he whispered, and shuddered at the sound of his own voice. He would go out into the kitchen, he decided, and make himself breakfast, just as if it were any ordinary day. A bachelor breakfast, full of comforting cholesterol. A couple of fried egg sandwiches with mayo and a slice of Bermuda onion on each one. He smelled sweaty and dirty and cruddy, but he would save the shower for later. Right now, getting undressed seemed like too much work, and he was afraid he might have to get the scalpel out of his bag and actually cut the leg of the pants open in order to allow his bloated knee to escape. A hell of a way to treat good instruments, but none of the knives in the house would cut the heavy jeans fabric, and Rachel's sewing scissors certainly would not do the trick. But first, breakfast. So he crossed the living room
and then detoured into the front entry and looked out at the small blue car in Judd's driveway. It was covered with dewfall, which meant it had been there for some time. Church was still on the roof, but not sleeping. He appeared to be staring right at Lewis with his ugly yellow-green eyes. Lewis stepped back hurriedly, as if someone had caught him peeking. He went into the kitchen, rattled out a frying pan, put it on the stove, got eggs from the fridge. The kitchen was bright and crisp and clear. He tried to whistle. A whistle would bring the morning into its proper focus, but he could not. Things looked right, but they weren't right. The house seemed dreadfully empty, and last night's work weighed on him. Things were wrong, awry. He felt a shadow hovering, and he was afraid. He limped into the bathroom and took a couple of aspirin with a glass of orange juice. He was working his way back to the stove when the telephone rang. He did not answer it immediately, but turned and looked at it, feeling slow and stupid, a sucker in some game which he was only now realizing he did not understand in the least. "Don't answer that. You don't want to answer that, because that's the bad news. That's the end of the leash that leads around the corner and into the darkness. And I don't think you want to see what's on the other end of that leash, Lewis. I really don't think you do, so don't answer that phone. Run. Run now. The car's in the garage. Get in it and take off. But don't answer that phone." He crossed the room and picked it up, standing there with one hand on the dryer, as he had so many times before. And it was Irwin Goldman. And even as Irwin said hello, Lewis saw the tracks crossing the kitchen, small, muddy tracks, and his heart seemed to freeze in his chest, and he believed he could feel his eyeballs swelling in his head, starting from their sockets. He believed that if he could have seen himself in the mirror at that moment, he would have seen a face out of a 17th-century painting of a lunatic asylum. They were Gage's tracks. Gage had been here. He had been here in the night. And so where was he now?
"It's Irwin, Lewis. Lewis, are you there? Hello?"
"Hello, Irwin," he said. And already he knew what Irwin was going to say. He understood the blue car. He understood everything. The leash. The leash going into the darkness. He was moving fast along it now, hand over hand. Ah, if he could drop it before he saw what was at the end. But it was his leash. He had bought it.
"For a moment I thought we'd been cut off," Goldman was saying.
"No, the phone slipped out of my hand," Lewis said. His voice was calm.
"Did Rachel make it home last night?"
"Oh, yes," Lewis said, thinking of the blue car, Church perched on top of it, the blue car that was so still. His eye traced the muddy footprints on the floor.
"I ought to speak to her," Goldman said. "Right away. It's about Eileen."
"Ellie? What about Ellie?"
"I really think Rachel's not here right now," Lewis said harshly. "She's gone to the store for bread and milk. What about Ellie? Come on, Irwin." "We had to take her to the hospital," Goldman said reluctantly. "She had a bad dream, or a whole series of them. She was hysterical and wouldn't come out of it.
Did they sedate her?"
"What?"
"Sedation," Lewis said impatiently. "Did they give her sedation?"
"Yes, oh, yes. They gave her a pill and she went back to sleep."
"Did she say anything? What scared her so badly?" He was gripping the phone white-knuckled now. Silence from Irwin Goldman's end. A long silence. This time Lewis did not interrupt, much as he would have liked to.
"That was what scared Dory so badly," Irwin said finally. "She babbled a lot before she was crying too hard to understand. Dory herself was almost, you know."
"What did she say?"
"She said Oz the Great and Terrible had killed her mother. Only she didn't say it that way. She said Oz the Great and Terrible, which was the way our other daughter always used to say it. Our daughter Zelda. Lewis, believe me when I say I would rather have asked Rachel this question. But how much have you and she told Eileen about Zelda, and how she died?"
Lewis had closed his eyes. The world seemed to be rocking gently under his feet, and Goldman's voice had the lost quality of a voice coming through thick mists.
You may hear sounds like voices, but they are only the loons down south toward Prospect. The sound carries. Lewis, are you there?
Is she going to be all right? Lewis asked, his own voice distant. Is Ellie going to be all right? Did you get a prognosis?
Delayed shock from the funeral, Goldman said. My own doctor came, Lathrop, a good man. Said she had a degree of fever, and that when she woke up this afternoon she might not even remember. But I think Rachel should come back.
Lewis, I am frightened. I think you should come back, too.
Lewis did not respond. The eye of God was on the sparrow, so said good King James. Lewis, however, was a lesser being, and his eye was on those muddy footprints. Lewis, Gage is dead, Goldman was saying. I know that must be hard to accept, for you and Rachel both, but your daughter is very much alive, and she needs you.
Yes, I accept that. You may be a stupid old fart, Erwin, but perhaps the nightmare that passed between your two daughters on that April day in 1965 taught you something about sensitivity. She needs me, but I can't come because I'm afraid, so terribly afraid, that my hands are filthy with her mother's blood.
Lewis regarded those hands. Lewis regarded the dirt under his nails, which was so like the dirt which comprised those footprints on the kitchen floor. All right, he said. I understand. We'll be there as soon as we can, Erwin. By tonight, if that's possible. Thank you.
We did the best we could, Goldman said. Maybe we're too old. Maybe, Lewis. Maybe we always were.
Did she say anything else? Lewis asked. Goldman's reply was like the toll of a funeral bell against the wall of his heart.
A lot, but only one other thing I could make out. Paxgal says it's too late.
He hung up the telephone and moved back toward the stove in a daze, apparently meaning to continue on with breakfast or put things away, he didn't know which. And about halfway across the kitchen, a wave of faintness poured over him. Floating gray overcame his sight, and he swooned to the floor. Swoon was the right word because it seemed to take forever. He fell down through cloudy depths. It seemed to him that he turned over and over, looped the loop, did a dipsy doodle or two, slipped an Immelman. Then he struck on his bad knee, and the chromium bolt of pain through his head brought him back with a scream of agony. For a moment he could only crouch, the tears starting from his eyes. At last he made it back to his feet and stood there swaying, but his head was clear again. That was something, wasn't it? The urge to flee came on him again for the last time, stronger than ever. He actually felt the comforting bulge of his car keys in his pocket. He would get in the Civic and drive to Chicago. He would get Ellie and go on from there. Of course, by then Goldman would know something was wrong, that something was dreadfully amiss, but he would get her anyway, snatch her if he had to. Then his hand fell away from the bulge of the keys. What killed the urge was not a sense of futility, not guilt, not despair or the deep weariness inside him. It was the sight of those muddy footprints on the kitchen floor. In his mind's eye, he could see them tracing a path across the entire country, first to Illinois, then to Florida, across the entire world, if necessary. What you bought, you owned, and what you owned eventually came home to you. There would come a day when he would open a door, and there would be Gage, a demented parody of his former self, grinning a sunken grin, his clear blue eyes gone yellow and smart stupid. Or Ellie would open the bathroom door for her morning shower, and there would be Gage in the tub, his body crisscrossed with the faded scars and bulges of his fatal accident, clean but stinking of the grave. Oh yes, that day would come. He didn't doubt it a bit.
How could I have been so stupid?
he said to the empty room, talking to himself again.